from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ken Perrini made his fortune as a forger, a fraud, a scoundrel of a sort, and in his own way, an artist. For nearly three decades, he carefully, masterfully forged celebrated works of art, duping auction houses, art dealers, and art collectors around the world out of millions. Now, perhaps the most accomplished forger in American history is out of the game, and he's sharing his story. This hour, On Point, the art forger and the secrets of his trade. You can join the conversation. What's your question on how it all works, on the life and trade secrets of the forger? Are you impressed with the artistry, horrified by the deception, the fakery? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Lots of fascination with this field of endeavor. A lot of it has come to Hollywood over the years. Here's a scene from the 1966 heist comedy film, How to Steal a Million. Audrey Hepburn, playing the lovely Nicole Bonnet, discusses the morality of producing and selling fake art with her father, played by Hugh Griffith, who is a career forger.
I doubt very much if Van Gogh himself would have gone to such pains with his work.
He didn't have to. He was Van Gogh.
But, my darling, you know that in his whole lifetime he only sold one painting, whereas I, in loving memory of his great tragic genius, have already sold two.
Papa, I keep telling you, when you sell a fake masterpiece, that is a crime.
But I don't sell them to poor people, I only sell them to millionaires. Then they get great paintings like this one.
Hey, I only sell them to millionaires. Joining me now from Tampa, Florida, is Ken Perrini. He's out with a new memoir, Caveat Emptor, The Secret Life of an American Art Forger. These days, he operates his own studio in Madeira Beach, Florida, and openly sells his artwork as reproductions. Ken Perrini, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I'm enjoying the show so far.
Well, good. This is a heck of a story, and I just really, really a story of more depth than facets that I have to say that I imagined going in. I guess we have to stipulate right from the top that you are a forger. And so, I mean, I found myself wondering, is this all true in this book? If you're willing to forge masterpieces, I suppose you could forge a narrative as well. But there's a lot that does ring true in this. The kid from the sort of the other side of the tracks, out of the other side of the river in Jersey, growing up in the 1960s, And give us just a sense of what turned your eye and mind and ultimately hand and artistry toward forging?
Well, I didn't plan to be an art forger. I didn't even plan to be an artist. My introduction to the art world happened in 1967. I was 17. And it was an exciting time to be young. All my friends were morphing into hippies,
right.
And we were into the lifestyle and all that went with it. There was an old estate that was not too far from my house, a couple of miles away, on the cliffs of the Hudson River in Fort Lee. Mm-hmm. It had a spectacular location. It was a crumbling down old place, and it was leased by an artist and some of his friends from New York City. Mm-hmm. They wanted to turn it into a design studio. I had a chance meeting with them one day, and I found myself having an open invitation to hang out with them at this old estate anytime I wanted to. Their life centered around the art world. In downtown New York City, they were going to the galleries and the openings and hung out at all the art bars. And they also went to the museums uptown, mm-hmm. the latest shows and so forth that went were presented there. And I started hanging out with them and going to all these new venues with them in the art world, and it started rubbing off on me.
It's quite a story. I mean, they're living that very dramatic kind of hippie, mm-hmm. Stoked-up lifestyle, and at the same
right.
time encouraging you, the son of the what, mm-hmm. tool and die maker, machinist, master machinist
right.
kind of your dad. But they're right. saying, hey, read this Voltaire and Balzac and Dostoevsky.
Yeah.
Look at these paintings, Titian and Rembrandt and Michelangelo, mm-hmm. and the whole world is opening up to you.
Exactly. I owe that to Tom Daly. He was the artist that leased the castle, and he was a great intellectual, Tom. But he was also a fun-loving guy. He liked to have parties. He liked to have his fun. But he was very educated, and he made art and literature interesting, even for a teenager. And I love spending time with Tom, and he got me started in everything.
But in the middle of all that high-minded stuff, there's also right away this, well, A, it's the 60s, so the establishment comes in for a lot of flaying, and B, there is a criminal thread. You had another sort of pal, mentor, guide at that time, call him what you will, who was going out, robbing at least one museum in upstate New York, just taking the hall.
Yes, my other friend there was Tom's buddy, Tony Masaccio. And I intermittently hung out with both of them and partook in their adventures. And Tony was a bit of a rascal, and he knew no bounds. So I was influenced a lot by Tom. But both of these new friends of mine were like 10 years my senior. I was very impressionable, mm-hmm. and I thought to me they were bigger than life. They were just great, and they were introducing me to things and places and people that otherwise I never would have met.
I got such a sense of the 60s here, and in a funny way, how even the Vietnam War plays a distinctive part in turning you toward a life off the straight and narrow.
Yeah, I think a lot of people my age that grew up in that period, they'll never forget the war, what it meant to us, our opposition to it for many of us, and how it affected our lives. In my case, it put me at a disadvantage for getting a job in the mainstream. So I was –
Because you had taken extreme steps to avoid the draft. You got a rating that showed you out to be kind of a ne'er-do-well, and employers weren't going to jump for you.
Exactly. I wouldn't say it was – very extreme. I mean, I knew friends that were going to Canada.
Yeah, okay.
But it put me on, I would say, at a disadvantage to get a legitimate job.
So here you were and began to sort of walk us into the skill set that you, by hook and crook, accumulated that made you into a master forger. I mean, your father's he was extremely handy, shall we say, and you had that kind of dexterity. You like to take old cars and fix them up, and pretty soon you're moving on to old furniture, which gave you a sense of wood and old wood and frames and maybe what paintings were mounted on. And how did you then come on into painting?
I wanted to fit in very much with my new friends. They were older than me. Everybody that was hanging out at this old house known as the Castle at that time had something going for them in the art world. And I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be more than just a hanger-on or a kid there and a chauffeur to a lot of them. So I in the brashness of youth, I guess, and going to the museums with them, I was looking at the old masters, and something just clicked. I felt if I had some brushes, I could understand how these artists from the past achieved what they did. So one day, Tom Daly gave me brushes, canvas, set me all up. Tom was a wonderful person, very encouraging and nurturing, and he wanted to see what I could do. Could I prove myself? Mm-hmm. And I did. But I didn't intend to be an art forger. I wanted to paint surrealistic pictures to be far out. I wanted to impress my friends with something, really bizarre.
He was a psychedelic illustrator. You wanted to be kind of in that same neck of the woods, and you did for a time, but then you came over ultimately, and I know we won't get to tell all of this story, but to some masters. What artists did you finally settle on forging the most, and why?
Well, in the beginning, just to get some pocket money for myself, I started out painting small Flemish portraits on wooden panels, which I understood how to paint them, how to age them, and I managed to sell those to dealers, not for a very great deal of money, but a few hundred dollars, which was good in those days for me. But the turning point came later on down the road. I was trying to put together a collection of contemporary art. I had every intention in the world to become a serious contemporary artist, part of the downtown New York movement of abstract impressionism of that time. But it seemed like events were conspiring against me. Either I was being thrown out of the loft I was renting with Tony, or some other thing would get in the way. And I had this gift for turning out a small fake every now and then, and I always had to fall back on that to support myself. But the real turning point came when I was eventually introduced to an eccentric collector of artworks north of New York City in the town of Pyrmont. His name was James Rico, and he was quite well known in the art world, and he put together a very, very important collection of paintings and artwork. It was his intention to introduce me to the painters of 19th century America.
And boy did he, and boy did you respond. Ken Perini, please stand by. The new book is Caveat Emptor, The Secret Life of an American Art Forger. A little music from the Thomas Crown Affair behind us right there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
It was bleeding around to the sea. It was bleeding around to the sea. It was bleeding all on that day. So I ran to the river. It was boiling around to the sea. It was boiling around to the sea. It was boiling all on that day. So I ran to the Lord. Please help me, Lord.
We're talking this hour with perhaps the most accomplished American art forger of all time about his life in the business, how he did it, how he got out, how he looks at art now. My guest is super forger Ken Perini. His new book telling the story is Caveat Emptor, The Secret Life of an American Art Forger. And it is intriguing stuff, to say the least, has been for a long time to Hollywood. Here's a little bit from the great Orson Welles' last directorial project was F for Fake, classic 1974 freeform documentary about the notorious Elmer Dehori, and Elmer's biographer Clifford Irving was interviewed for the film and provided a rather unique take here on art criticism.
The important distinction to make when you're talking about the genuine quality of a painting is not so much whether it's a real painting or a fake. It's whether it's a good fake or a bad fake.
Clifford Irving in Orson Welles' F is for Fake. You worked in an art restoration shop studio in Manhattan for a while, and then got deeper into the world. Tell us about the artist that you chose we shouldn't say you weren't forging, you weren't recreating paintings that they did. You always looked to make paintings that looked as if they would be one of these artists' paintings, right?
Often that was the case. In some instances, you could make almost an exact copy or another version of a known painting by a particular artist, because the artist himself made versions of his paintings. Other times, you have to create an entirely new painting in the style of the artist and understand how he thinks, how his mind works, and how he conceptualizes a painting.
How did you choose which artists to emulate?
Well, as I said in the beginning, I started on my own on what just seemed simple to me, Flemish portraits, some Dutch paintings. But when I met the collector, Jimmy Rico, mm-hmm. he chose the paintings for me. He had seen some examples of my work, and he was impressed. He wanted very much to meet me, and it was his intention to educate me in the area of 19th century American paintings and steer my talents into that direction. That was his great love in art, 19th century America. And he was amused by me. He was an eccentric. He really didn't care about the conventions of the art world or the morality of it. He simply wanted to see if he could tutor me in the area of 19th century American painters, and he picked out several of them that he thought my talents could be adapted to.
So Martin Johnson Heed, for example, the famous hummingbirds in South America,
yes.
that were so wildly popular in the 19th century.
Right.
And you went to town with that genre. And who else?
James E. Buttersworth, America's most important marine painter of the 19th century. And
sailing ships looking great at sea, all that.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Very exciting paintings. And there was William Aiken Walker, who painted scenes in the South, cabin scenes and so on. And
cabins and slaves and farmyards mm-hmm. and all that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Right. Yeah. And let's see. Charles Bird King, who painted portraits of American Indians who came to Washington to sign treaties and accept peace medals and so on. So there was a range of them that Jimmy introduced me to.
Boy, it's incredible. And how did you sell these paintings? How did they get into the market? How do you go about selling a forgery?
Well, in those days, it was very easy. This was an emerging market, you could call it. It was a time when these artists that I'm mentioning here and that Jimmy introduced me to, they were not second-rate artists. They were important artists that were just recently being fully appreciated mm-hmm. in the marketplace.
Okay.
Therefore, there was a great reservoir of them still laying around in people's attics, hanging on their walls.
Not really cataloged.
Exactly. And there was never an inventory kept by the artists of how many paintings they produced. So if you simply had one of these and walked into an important Madison Avenue gallery with one of these under your arm and said, I just found this in a secondhand store or I inherited it, I'm interested in finding out what it's worth, I may want to sell it. It was as simple as that.
And what struck me reading all this was that they didn't seem very skeptical. Were they not skeptical, or it was in their interest not to be skeptical because they didn't want to know if it was a forgery?
Well, I don't wish to flatter myself, but they were very fine pieces, I turned out. And there was also the fact that they really didn't expect anyone faking Martin Johnson Heads or James E. Buttersworth at that time. Mm-hmm. They would expect a Picasso fake or a Monet or something like mm-hmm. that. But who would be faking James E. Buttersworth? But it took Jimmy's insidious genius to target these particular artists.
Give us a sense, sort of build it from the wood up of how you would go about this. I mean, I love some of these stories. You had been into antique furniture, so you noticed mm-hmm. that the wood you could find in the bottom drawer of old chests that weren't that valuable, you could get your hands on it. You talked with a great frame maker, an old one in Manhattan, about the
yes.
what, rabbit skin kind of glue that went into getting the right,
right
crackle. And start at the bottom and give us a little tutor.
Yeah, well, it was an evolution. It started out with the brilliant idea to get the bottom of a drawer out of some antique furniture, which looked very similar to the kind of panels that I saw early Flemish paintings painted on. So just using, I guess, maybe what I ingeniousness I got from my father, I figured, well, I'll put a nice portrait on here. I'll engrave cracks very, very finely on there, and I managed to sell them. But as time went on, I had to graduate from panels to canvas, especially after meeting Jimmy, because a lot of the 19th century American paintings were produced on canvas.
Sure.
Or the closest thing to a wood panel would have been what's called an academy board, which was a patented piece of cardboard made for artists in the 19th century that had a gesso finish on it. Mr. Jory was another man that I met. He had a frame shop on Lexington Avenue in New York City. He had a very interesting life, and he settled in New York City in the early part of the in the 30s, I believe.
From a family of great frame makers going way back into Europe.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. He came from a dynasty of mm-hmm. frame makers. He mm-hmm. was a very interesting man. He fought in World War I. He was practically killed in the Battle of the Somme, came to America, set up a shop.
And he gave you a couple of jars of stuff that turned mm-hmm. out to be really critical.
Exactly. From a technical standpoint, he was to my career what Jimmy Rico was to advancing my product line. He introduced me to the method of producing gesso the way the old masters did.
Now, gesso is what? This is a kind of primer.
Yes, it's the primer that's spread onto the canvas or a panel that allows you to have a nice surface to paint your picture on. And part of the formula is gypsum powder, rabbit skin glue, which is the binding agent, okay. and water.
Yeah.
But I discovered that rabbit skin glue, if it's added in enough volume in the formula, had a great propensity for producing cracks.
The kind of cracks associated with aging.
Exactly. So this was a major technical breakthrough for me, and it allowed me to expand my repertoire into many other areas of art.
And so we get going. I mean, there are all kinds of elements that come in here. The patina, you hold you hold one of these under a UV light, and if it's really old, it's going to give off a kind of a green glow. You figured you could wash old varnish off old paintings, reapply it to your new paintings, and you'd get that glow, which fooled just about everybody.
Yes, it did. It was quite a what I call a eureka moment for me. I didn't really think of the idea. It happened accidentally when I was cleaning a painting. I was removing the old varnish with solvents. I had an ultraviolet light near the table to inspect the painting because ultraviolet light detects old varnish that's on the surface of a painting. And when you clean a painting, you want to see if you've left any spots uncleaned. And I noticed that the swabs the pile of swabs that I had used to clean the painting were glowing under the light. Right. And I figured, well, why don't I just wring out this old varnish, do a little work on it, reconstitute it a bit, and spray it onto one of my masterpieces.
And voila, it would show up as looking green and old under a UV light. You were in museums with a special 35-millimeter cameras with a special lens and filter and film. You looked like any tourist, but in fact, you were taking high-zoom close-up photos of very small details, signatures, brushstrokes, technical details that would help you, again, forge.
Yes, I always believed that to start any new project, I had to – I really got into the project. I studied the life of the artist. I went to museums. I wanted to look at actual examples of his work up close. I did have a camera that I could zoom in on. I would collect photographs of signatures and other peculiarities in the way he may handle a brush stroke in his work. So I put in a great deal of research work in any new artist I was contemplating on imitating.
Ken Pirini, we're going to hear in just a moment from conservation scientists, art forgery specialists, about how they track down forgeries, perhaps like yours, but a couple calls from our listeners first, a lot of them here. Mark in Somerville, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air with Ken Pirini.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What I wanted to ask Ken was about his studies and looking at paintings and brushstrokes. I saw a speech from a conservator from the Rijksmuseum, and he had mentioned one of the ways they tell forgeries is by the number of brush strokes per square inch. And he said that forgers tend to use a lot more than the original artist. And so I was wondering what Ken's experience is with that.
Ken?
Yes, I think that's an interesting idea. Perhaps if it's an inferior forgery, that might be true. But I would say the examining a painting for that type of a telltale flaw probably is something that's being done after the painting is challenged as a fake. I've always found that experts always trust their eyes first. They simply feel that they cannot be fooled. They trust in their experience. And if it's a very well-executed, high-class fake, it will pass muster. But I would also say that in my case, I was very aware of the patternation of brushstroking and always made sure that I was uniform in those areas with the original painter.
So pay attention. Get that camera out. Look closely. Follow the kind of brushstrokes that are there. Portsmouth, Virginia. Robert's calling. Robert, you're on the air.
This is very exciting. Ken, I'm a brother, really, and I really appreciate what you do. There's so very few of us today that understand the technique that the masters use.
But Robert, this is fraud. This is forgery. What do you mean it's so marvelous?
Well, no, the process itself of being able to paint, I don't know very many people in the world today that really know how to paint. I do. I have an attic full of hundreds of year-old pigments. I have 300-year-old Dutch brushes. I know how to paint, and it's just exciting to be able to paint like Rembrandt or Titian, who are all using variations of the same technique. But today, it's very hard for a forger to forge anything. You can dissolve old paintings for the pigments. We can dissolve canvases of their paintings and reuse the canvases and make the old gesso, make it overly strong so it'll crack. It's just exciting. It's just the whole thing to be able to get into the psyche of a Rubens or a Titian or a Rembrandt. It's just amazing. I own some real paintings. I have some Peel paintings, and people think that I've done them. I've had trouble selling them. But I really like that. I studied with a forger in London. He was an old man in his 90s, and he opened my eyes to paint, and he explained to me that the old oils, like linseed oil, for instance, the plants have changed. It's not the same oil. And he showed me how to make the oil behave like the old oil. And it's just the whole thing. It's science.
So maybe you and Ken are brothers in crime. Do you have a question for your fellow traveler?
Yes, I do. I mean, we shouldn't feel guilty about what we've done.
Well, why not? Doesn't someone own? I mean, somebody else invented the look, the feel, the artistry, and then aren't you kind of mooching off it?
If you don't claim it as theirs.
Oh well, but he did.
See, that's what I'm saying. But I would like to know where he learned how to paint. Biggest thing is you have to be able to see. And he mentioned Charles Bird King, which would be a great, great uncle of mine. And he forged any of Charles Bird King's paintings. I mean, there's America, there's so many painters that we've had here that are not really, that you can forge. I mean, no one would ever know, but today they can look at your painting and they can tell where the pigments came from. They can tell if there's chlorine in the water you use for your gesso, on and on and on. I've even made lapis. Hand ground the stuff to get that kind of blue for old paintings. It's just an amazing thing that the artist today that would forge is just as talented as the old masters, and he has to be able to think like them.
Robert, you're right on Ken's wavelength here, and I'm sure he's nodding along, but even if you can get into the psyche of Charles Bird King and those wonderful Native American portraits, what about all the technical traps? Is there chlorine in the water? They've got you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that there is a truth in that. There's a hundred ways a forger could be tripped up today with the new technology. But I would submit that experts will still always trust their judgment and their eyes. And let me say, this is the most important point on that subject. Paintings cannot. It is a myth. It is a myth that paintings are routinely subjected to scientific tests. They are expensive. They are impractical. And auction houses receive hundreds of paintings in a year, maybe thousands. And they simply cannot, in any practical sense, guarantee what a painting is by subjecting it to technical analyses. So it only happens when a painting is challenged to be a fake.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with one of the most accomplished American art forgers of all time, about his life in the business, about how he did it, how he got out, how he looks at art and his work now. My guest is American super forger Ken Perini. He's telling his story in a new book. It's called Caveat Emptor, The Secret Life of an American Art Forger. And it really tells quite a tale. Joins us today from Tampa, Florida. Ken Perini says that he actually came under a big investigation at some point, and that investigation was finally closed. Statute of limitations has run out, and he's telling, oh, there's rumors of a movie deal here. Ron Howard, we'll see. He joins us from Tampa. With us right now from West Hartford, Connecticut, is Henry DePhillips. He's an art conservation scientist, art forgery specialist, and uses chemistry to identify fake art. Professor of Chemistry Emeritus at Trinity College, Mr. DePhillips, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So first of all, how do you feel about being on the air with a self-proclaimed longtime art forger.
Well, I love it, actually. I read his book, and I'm very, very impressed by it. In fact, many of the details he explains in his book about creating his forgeries I actually use in an art conservation class that I actually teach at the college and in other places around the world. So I very much enjoyed the book.
Well, I mean, you say you love it, but here, I mean, I've got listeners online. Here's one. Christopher says, why don't you spend an hour talking to creative people instead of charlatans?
Well, yeah, sure, that's true, but we're talking specifically about the art world, mm-hmm. and I think Ken made the key point, namely that there are people out there who simply want to have a named artist in their collection, no matter where it's from, and they will willingly purchase an artwork without having any idea of the provenance or so-called history of the artwork, whether it's been authenticated or not, and it's simply the law of supply and demand operating.
Now Ken asserts, and it seems to have worked out in his case for a long time, that the eye is what really gets applied here, that if it looks good enough, if it looks close enough, compelling, people won't go further in testing. But if you brought your technology to bear on his or other forger's paintings, what is your arsenal of techniques for discovering, Henry?
Well, the technology is incredible, and Ken is quite right that if there were the opportunity to investigate every work of art that's out there, thousands, hundreds of thousands of them would actually be uncovered.
As forgeries.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Just to give you one example, it is estimated that Camille Corot forgeries number over 10,000 out there. And that's just one example. And the reason Ken gave as to why they are out there is because art museums, private collectors, and so on simply don't have the resources to have their work authenticated. In terms of the actual technology itself, we have some very sophisticated technology to investigate artworks, primarily for their material aspects. And during those investigations, oftentimes, that forgeries are discovered. And I've discovered several of them over the years in this particular field.
I mean, at this point, you've got neutron analysis and digital imaging. And we even saw, I think you did as well, the story about what a hair extracted from a purported Van Gogh to see if the DNA in that hair matched him or his relatives. That's kind of incredible.
That's correct. And to just go back to one of the former callers and the response that Ken gave him about digital authentication, that now has become very sophisticated, and I would be willing to bet that even Ken's excellent forgeries would well be detected if compared with the originals. It's called digital authentication. It has been done, for example, in the Netherlands on several Van Goghs, and in fact, the Van Gogh Institute had a fake Van Gogh commissioned, and that fake Van Gogh was sent to several laboratories around the world, and all of the laboratories, once they had the library of the brushstroke analysis of some authentic Van Goghs, they all identified the fake.
We'll put it to Ken Perini, but a couple of callers first, if I may. Nancy in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Nancy, you're on with Henry DePhillips and Ken Perini.
Yes. With all due respect to the forgers, I want to bring up the point that copying is not that difficult. Once, in my opinion, because I was a draftsman for years and now I paint, mm-hmm. and the local art community here spends much of their time doing nothing but copying other people's work because it's easier to learn that way. So I kind of argue that it's not that hard to copy something. I'm not speaking about the chemistry of art. I'm talking basically about having the ability to say, that, you know, mix your colors and collect your brush strokes and blend as you can see it on a painting. So,
hey, it's just draftsmanship, Ken. What do you say to Nancy? No big deal. People can copy.
Well, try to make one someday and pass it off as an original, and you'll find it's a little more complicated. It is true that you could save a certain amount of time by making a close copy of a particular period painting. And as I said, I did that when the artist was known to do that himself. But a great fake is an overall package. It has to have the patina. It has to have the visual forensics, as I call them, to pass muster with the experts at the auction houses and be accepted as a period work.
Cheryl in Newton, Massachusetts. Cheryl, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm listening to your show, and I'm on the way to visit a family member who's really very seriously ill. And this personal situation has really made me kind of simplify the way I look at life in terms of really what's important and what priorities are and what's right and wrong.
Good.
And I'm sorry to say that when I listen to your guest, he's just a bad guy. You know, I don't care if he's talented and, you know, all this talk about getting into Titian's head and Rembrandt's. He's a bad guy. He's made bad decisions. He's a fraud. And I don't care how you dress up. It's a bad choice. And we need better people than that in this world to make good choices.
Cheryl, I appreciate your call. And we wish the best for your family member there, Ken Pirani. But that's tough. And it's right in your face and saying, come on, dress it up any way you like. You know, this is bad. You're a bad guy.
Well, I respect everybody's opinion, and I could understand how she could see that. For me, it was a contest of wits. And as a previous caller stated, it is exciting. It's exhilarating. It's fascinating. And for me, it was an intoxicant, and I loved every moment of it.
What about the notion that you're a fraud, you're stealing? I mean, did you feel like you were stealing in effect from the original artist, that you were stealing from those who bought your paintings, Ken?
Well, I didn't look at it quite that way. I felt that it is true I was duping, but I was duping auction houses. If anyone discovered that a painting they purchased in an auction turned out to be one of mine, they could always go back to the auction house and get a refund.
Did that happen?
I don't know, but I would imagine it may be in the past it could have. But we're dealing here with not exactly poor people either.
Yeah, we heard the movie at the top saying, hey, they're millionaires. But still, Henry DePhillips, I mean, your work is tracking down the work of guys like Ken. How do you look at the ethics of this?
Well, the ethics are certainly apart from the work that I do. My work deals with the material world, not the philosophical world. And when a particular work of art comes to me, the questions that I need to answer is, what are the materials? Are they consistent with the artist's palette? Is the wood frame on which it's painted or the canvas on which it's painted from the time or the frames authentic, et cetera, et cetera? And it's that information that then goes into the judgment as to whether or not the work is authentic. The ethics then goes a little bit beyond what I am asked to do. On the other hand, I do worry about art that is not authentic getting into the mainstream and becoming part of the history of art, just as we would not want a rogue historian to start creating past history. I don't think it's appropriate for artists to create past art.
And that's a real issue. I mean, what's the rule of thumb here? It's some very large percentages, you were saying, of art in private collections and even in museums that are likely forgeries. What kind of percentages?
Well, I mean, these numbers are numbers that you can argue with, but the numbers are such that estimates are that 40% of the works in private collections is probably forged, and 25% of the work that you see when you're walking through a museum is probably forged as well. And the reason why there's so much forged work out there is because these folks simply cannot afford the price to have every last piece of work that they want to show authenticated.
Wow, it's incredible. Henry DePhillips in West Hartford, Connecticut, professor of chemistry emeritus at Trinity College and an art forgery specialist. Thank you so much for joining us, Henry.
Thanks, Tom.
Gina in Lexington, Massachusetts, you're on with Ken Pirani.
Hi, Tom. Ken, I was wondering whether there's a piece that you are especially proud of from among your years of work, and also maybe knowing what is the most famous piece that you ever forged.
Thank you for the question. I'm particularly proud of mastering the hand of the British painter, John F. Herring, Sr. He was an equestrian painter in the 19th century, and he was famous for his very finely polished portraits of thoroughbred racehorses and jockeys. And it's a very difficult technique to understand and master. And I believe I have grasped his technique and to perfection. And I'm particularly proud of my work in Herring, but also in James Buttersworth, too, the American 19th century marine painter, because, again, that's a very difficult artist to imitate. You have to have a very fine hand and understanding to make a correct Buttersworth.
And I guess you must have found it. I mean, I'm looking here at all kinds of what these look like, auction house catalogs and magazines, where your work, forged work, is very prominently featured as the real deal.
Yes, in each one of those pictured there, and that's a sampling, I would have at least one work in those publications. And many times I had multiple pieces being sold in sales.
What is the satisfaction that comes from – I mean, you mastered the hand. It's a wonderful phrase, I guess. It is in many ways the ultimate sort of forger's compliment or goal. On the other hand, it's mastering someone else's hand. So, okay, you've found your way around it ethically, but what about just in terms of life satisfaction? Do you sit back and say, gosh, if only I'd found my own hand in my own path of expression?
I don't feel that way. I don't feel any frustration of not developing my talents as a contemporary artist. But I felt I was more than adequately compensated by the thrills of sitting in a sales room and watching one of my works being brought up on a stage and being handled by porters with little white gloves on, and watching it being sold as an original painting. I can't it's hard to explain the exhilaration that one feels from that.
Well, Joe in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Ken Perini.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Joe.
How are you?
Fine.
Yes, I have a question for your guest. I'm even if I weren't a painter, I would have this question here in Cambridge. I wonder if Mr. Perini at this time would like to take the opportunity to dedicate the profits from his book, the sale of his paintings, and the possible profits from a movie to restitution to people whom he has criminally defrauded.
Ken, that's a big question.
Would I be willing to
hand it over?
No, absolutely not. That's my answer.
And why not? What's your justification for that? Do you think that they weren't, in fact, cheated?
Well, as one previous caller stated, it's a matter of philosophy. I have felt that I've always made a significant contribution to the art world. I believe that the artists that I imitated would be flattered. In fact, I believe that they would thank me that hundreds of years after they've died, someone has studied them so closely and devoted so much time and effort in understanding their way of creating art that I have been able to carry on their tradition and create works of art that I believe they would be happy to sign themselves if they were alive today.
Joe, I don't know if that's going to satisfy you, but there's Ken's way. Ken, you've slipped through the statute of limitations. You're on the other side of that now, but you're still painting, and you're still painting. I mean, they would be forgeries, I guess, except that you no longer sell them surreptitiously as the real deal. People know you painted them, and what kind of thing are you painting now, and who buys, Ken?
I am painting what I pretty much what I've established years ago my standard 19th century American paintings and British paintings, my equestrian collection. But I'm also exploring the area going back to old masters again, where I started when I was young. I do a lot of what I call grand tour paintings, the decorative painters of the 18th century that sold their paintings of ruins and monuments to the English tourists that came to Italy on the grand tour. Mm-hmm. But yes, I sell them as reproductions, but I would say that the quality is every bit equal to or exceeding the paintings that I sold as originals in years past.
Can we find them on the walls in the big mansions in Palm Beach these days, Ken?
Oh, yes, very much so. All my clients are very wealthy people.
Wow, there's the market. Wow, and the movie rumor, is it real or are we going to see this on the big screen? Do you know?
Well, I could say for sure it's been optioned. So, and there's a lot of rumors flying around, and I've heard that's the way of Hollywood. So until we, you know, something definitive happens, but it has been optioned.
Like the trade or not, it is quite a story. The new book is Caveat Emptor, The Secret Life of an American Art Forger. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ken Perrani, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.